There were some people there at Breakfast Church that work in the tax office. They were slightly worried about whether they should turn up. And I'm glad Matt did give that notice about Joe and explaining who he was, because some of you might have thought he was the new comms and worship leader, but he's not. He didn't get the job. So, sorry, I should qualify that. He didn't actually apply for the job. But he actually has been very helpful in a great deal of assistance in our recruitment drive. Before I carry on, just a question to ask yourselves, or if you'd like to be so bold, the person next to you. When you go abroad, for example, on holiday, do you try and fit in with the culture, the language, the cuisine, or do you just eat British food, speak English, and don't go out of your hotel just in case you meet a foreigner? And the second question, if you're not from the UK, how do you cope with the eccentricities of the British way of life? Just a couple of minutes with the person next to you just to ask those questions. Okay, I don't know how you got on with that question. Can see it's provoked a bit of response. I won't ask the people from the UK how they cope with the British way of life. We will be thinking about a clash of cultures shortly as we'll be looking at the life of Jesus through the eyes of Matthew, who was an eyewitness account. But let me first tell you about the influence of the Romans. It is massive. Take, for example, the months of the year. January is named after a Roman god. February is named after a Roman festival. March is named after Mars, the Roman god of war. April, the Romans called it Aprilis, which means open, like opening a flower. We've got June, named after a Roman goddess. I mean, there are plenty of good British names for these months, but for some reason, somebody decided years ago to give them Roman names. Even July and August are named after two Roman historical figures. Julius Caesar, one of the most famous Roman statesmen, was July, and August is named after Caesar Augustus, the first Roman emperor. And we can see traces in the Roman world today. We can go to here in France. That's an aqueduct, which is, you know, it's incredible, 2,000 years old. And here's the Colosseum. And it's tiered seating, oval shape, numerous exits in case of an emergency. Even the way it's built still resonates with many stadiums today. They are oval. They are built with tiered seating. They have numerous escape exits and so on. But you don't have to go to Rome. Of course, you can go to local places like the Roman baths in Bath, Matt. Bath. And locally, you can go to Bignall Roman Villa and Fishbourne Roman Palace. Ancient Rome has a huge influence on the modern world. Even though it's been 1,500 years since the Roman Empire flourished, we can see evidence in our art, our culture, our technology, literature, language, and so on. From bridges to stadiums, but what was it actually like living under Roman occupation in first century Israel? And that's what we're going to be looking at this morning, focusing on two particular problems. You see, I'm sure it was great having amphitheatres, roads, stadiums, central heating, viaducts. But actually, how was it going to be paid for? Well, the answer is quite simple. Tax. We read in Luke chapter 2, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to the town to register." That's a famous passage from the beginning of the Nativity story. So you went to register at the census, and while you're there, you're taxed at the same time. Now, there's not much evidence outside the Bible about this incident, but no matter, it tells us that there was It's the first census. So guess what? He did it again and again. The imperial tax, or poll tax as it was called, wasn't a one-off. Historical records, and it's in the Bible again, in Acts chapter 5, verse 37, he did it again and again. It's likely, on top of all the other taxes that people had to pay, the poll tax was a regular feature of first century Roman taxation. So much so, there were poll tax riots in first century Israel, much like the poll tax riots in London in 1990, when the poll tax was reintroduced for reasons I'm not going to go into. Nobody really much liked paying tax, much like they don't pay like paying tax today. But that wasn't the only problem. There was the Roman Emperor. We're going to be looking at a passage from the Bible that when the Roman Emperor was Tiberius Julius Caesar Augustus. Nothing like giving somebody original names when you have a child, is there? But anyway, Tiberius, as he's called, he wasn't just an emperor, he was God. Imagine how that went down in a Jewish nation. The people didn't like paying tax, and they certainly didn't like the idea that the person in charge thinks they're a god. So let me introduce you to two groups of people. Firstly, the Pharisees. They crop up regularly, don't they, in these stories from Matthew. They were the religious leaders of the day, and they were passionately opposed to obeying a non-Jewish leader like Tiberius, and they certainly weren't going to worship him as a god. They had better uses of their money than to give it to Rome. And the second group of people are the Herodians. They were political activists, and as the name suggests, they wanted Herod to be in charge. But Herod wasn't really in charge at all. He was a spare. His nickname was the Fox, so he probably had red hair. He married a foreigner. He felt he had been ostracized. He hated his brother, who he thought had more power. And he was often disagreeing with the way power was distributed, and he ended up in exile. That wouldn't happen, obviously, to any member of the royal family today, but we are talking about 2,000 years ago. Now, the Pharisees and the Herodians didn't see eye to eye on almost anything, but there was one thing they did agree on. They did not like Jesus. The Pharisees didn't like Jesus because of his popularity that threatened their own. They didn't like his teaching that was far too reliant on the Old Testament than their interpretation of what it said, and it could ruin their grip on power. But the Herodians didn't like Jesus for his claim to be king of the Jews. We read about their efforts to kill him in the Nativity story in Matthew chapter 2. So they came together to trap Jesus, and the question they asked Jesus was this: what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? And it's easy to see why they chose that question, because it was a trap. It appeared to that no matter what side Jesus took, he would be in trouble. For if he opposed the tax, he really would be in big trouble with the Roman authorities. If he approved the tax, he would be effectively worshipping Caesar, wouldn't he? And he would be in big trouble with the Jews. So let's see what actually happens. It's in Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22. The Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus with his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then he said to them, "So give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." When they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. So Jesus immediately sees through their scheme. He knew the real purpose wasn't to get an answer to the question, but to trap him. He could have just not answered, but it's doubtful if Jesus' followers would understand, so he chose this opportunity to teach an important lesson. Much like today, each ruler minted their own coins and put their image on it. The coin called the denarius had Caesar's image on it, so it belonged to Caesar. But Jesus also implies this: people are created in the image of God, so we belong to God. So Christians have a dual citizenship. We are citizens of two kingdoms. We are citizens of the United Kingdom and citizens of heaven. We are to obey earthly rulers, obey the law, pay taxes, pray for those in authority, but we must also obey God. Caesar was not God. Governments mustn't enforce religion, neither should they restrict freedom of worship. And as we know, around the world, that is not how some governments behave. But let's think about this a bit more personally. Where do you feel most comfortable? As a citizen of the United Kingdom or as a citizen of heaven? Where do you naturally gravitate towards? Heaven or this world? A citizen of heaven or a citizen of this world? For some, it's the kingdom of heaven. We really don't want much to do with this world. And after hearing Matt's talk telling us there's 75 genders, we might have thought, that's it, I'm a citizen of heaven, and although I don't want to die, I'm not really going to be upset when I leave this world. As the expression goes, stop the world, I want to get off. The problem is, you can become holier than thou, a bit like a Pharisee. As somebody said, so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. You can't tell the good news to anyone because you don't want to mix with anyone other than people like you. So perhaps you prefer and gravitate towards being a citizen of the world. You believe in the 21st century and all its benefits and freedoms. The problem with that is you start treating the teachings of the Bible as a bit old-fashioned and no relevance today. You have what it's called a pick-and-mix religion, just believing the bits you want. You're unable to articulate Jesus' teaching today, and you get a bit wishy-washy in your beliefs. As the saying goes, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. So what are we to do? If we are citizens of this world and citizens of heaven, how do we choose? Well, the answer, as always, is Jesus. In his statement, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give to God what belongs to God, Jesus is saying, well, embrace both. Because Jesus did. He absolutely embraced first century Middle Eastern life. He lived there, worked there, attended weddings and funerals. He met and ate in people's homes, went to the synagogue and so on. He celebrated Passover and other Jewish feasts. His parables are heavily influenced by first century Israel. They're about sheep and goats and servants and masters and Samaritans and local dangerous roads. But Jesus just didn't embrace first century Middle Eastern life. He absolutely embraced the kingdom of heaven. I hope you're not going to check, but on my reckoning, in Matthew's gospel alone, Jesus spoke on the kingdom of heaven around 30 times, It's the main theme of all his teaching. So it's probably best to think about it slightly differently. Instead of being citizens of two competing kingdoms, let's think of it like this. We are ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven wherever we happen to be. If you've ever been to an embassy, you'll know how much they represent the country they stand for, even if they're situated in another country. I've been to a couple of embassies in London, and believe me, you absolutely know which country they stand for. There's people in military uniform with flags everywhere, and there's flags of the country, and just to be, you know, token gesture, a little flag of the Union Jack just in a corner somewhere. We are ambassadors of Jesus wherever we are in the world, representing the truth and light to a dark and needy world. So we need to know where we stand. Are we so fixated on the kingdom of heaven that we can't relate to the very people that need to hear the good news? Or are we so fixated on the ways of this world we have allowed it to be squeezed into its... What's the expression? We've allowed ourselves to be squeezed into the world's mould. We've been tossed around by every idea that comes around, and we start replacing God with the spirit of this world. So why don't we commit ourselves this morning to be ambassadors of the kingdom? Citizens of God's kingdom, but living in the kingdoms of this world as ambassadors, wherever that may be. And we can find it in St. Paul's letter. Oh, that was a question from Breakfast Church. Sorry about that. Don't want to do too many questions. St. Paul in 2 Corinthians says this, that we are to be ambassadors of Jesus. This is being foremost a citizen of heaven, but being an ambassador wherever in the world we may be. Let me just read you a bit from 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20. The task is this, making others Jesus' friends too. It's the ministry of reconciliation. God reconciled the world through Jesus and thereby not counting people's sins against them. Therefore, we are Jesus Christ's ambassadors. So what does it actually mean to be an ambassador? So to conclude, I just want to very quickly go through 10 things that being an ambassador is. And as we go through these 10 things, I want you to think which ones you're doing well, which ones you're not quite so good at, and which ones you're not doing very well at all at. And try and think of yourself as an ambassador of Jesus wherever you are in the world, using these as a guide. So this is what ambassadors of Jesus are like. Firstly, they are attractive. An ambassador will act with grace, kindness, and good manners. They will not dishonor Jesus in their conduct. An ambassador is meek. An ambassador is provisional in their claims, knowing that their understanding of truth is fallible. They will not press a point beyond which the evidence allows. However, an ambassador of Jesus is also a believer. An ambassador has informed convictions, not just feelings, gives reasons, asks questions, seeks answers, and will not be stumped by the same challenge twice. An ambassador is also accurate. An ambassador is careful with language and will not rely on Christian lingo nor gain an unfair advantage by resorting to employed rhetoric. An ambassador is also strategic. An ambassador adapts to each unique person and situation, maneuvering with wisdom to challenge bad thinking, presenting the truth in an understandable and compelling way. An ambassador is also sympathetic and understanding towards others, and will acknowledge the merits of contrary views. An ambassador is attentive. An ambassador won't quarrel, but listen attentively in order to understand. Then will gentleness seek to respectfully engage those who disagree. An ambassador is also dependent. An ambassador knows that effectiveness requires joining their best efforts with God's spiritual power. An ambassador is open, careful with the facts, open and honest, not misrepresenting another view, overstating their own case, or understating the demands of the gospel. And finally, an ambassador is ready. An ambassador is alert for chances to represent Jesus Christ and will not back away from a challenge or an opportunity. And of course, it spells ambassador. Of course it does. You have no idea how long that took me. So let me end by asking you this simple question. And I'm asking it, obviously, of myself as well. How am I doing at being an ambassador? What qualities have I got to be an ambassador in this world? If I truly say I'm a citizen of heaven and I am an ambassador in wherever I find myself, how am I doing against that list? What qualities do I have, and what ones do I need to work on?